Welcome back. Espionage has shaped the course of history, from the secret agents and codebreakers of World War II to the double agents and defectors of the Cold War. Intelligence operations have influenced diplomacy, fueled conflicts, and decided the fates of nations. But beyond the real-world spycraft, espionage fiction can be a useful historical source, as this popular genre mirrors the various ideologies and political tensions of the 20th century, and as a number of the practitioners of the art of espionage fiction were also involved in real espionage themselves. Joining me now is Martin Griffin, Associate Professor in the Department of English at the University of Tennessee in Knoxville. He's the author of the book Reading Espionage Fiction, Narrative, Conflict and Commitment from World War I to the Contemporary Era. And he joins me now on the line from Knoxville. Martin, you're very welcome indeed to the History Show.
Thank you, Miles. Glad to be here.
Now, let's start with your own connection to espionage fiction. I think you've been a fan since you were a very, very young man. And I think you have read espionage fiction that most of us wouldn't even recognize, most of us would never have heard of.
That's true. I certainly started reading espionage fiction when I was maybe around 12 or 13. I became fascinated with it, and certainly there are a lot of novels that came out in the late 60s, in the 70s, probably most of them long forgotten and out of print, but there was something that made a large impression on me. And I, you know, this is many years later, of course, many decades later, but I knew, you know, when I became a professor that ultimately I wanted to write something about it and to go back and look at not only the well-known names, but a few of the more obscure ones as well.
Because it's a genre that goes all the way from pulp to literary, isn't it? I mean, you've got pulp espionage fiction, you've got literary espionage fiction, the Le Carrés of this world.
I think you can say that, yes. There are definitely authors who have been more ambitious than others. They've aimed for something a little more complex, a little more probing. And I guess I argue in the book that authors, in a sense, they created the genre for themselves. And many authors, I think, have also worked in it, but also tried to get beyond the genre, which has been difficult, I think. And it has worked for some people, not for others.
Now, I'm assuming that, or at least my information is that you've never worked in intelligence. And if I said otherwise, you'd probably have to kill me. But as far as you can divine, how realistic is espionage fiction compared to actual intelligence work?
I think it depends a great deal on what the author wants to do. I mean, some espionage fiction authors have had substantial or reasonable amount of experience themselves in intelligence work. Curiously, I mean, two people whose novels are often seen as diametrically opposed in style and atmosphere, Ian Fleming and John le Carré, both worked in British intelligence at different times. And to an extent, obviously, I think most authors who write about a professional milieu that they have worked in themselves, whether it's medicine, whether it's education, whether it's intelligence work, whether it's journalism, they do bring their experience to bear upon their writing. But of course, at the end of the day, most of them want to be recognized as novelists. They're not, you know, history writers. They're not doing a documentary film. So I think it very much depends on how much the author is shaping their fiction around their professional experience. And I think some do it to a greater extent than others.
Okay, well, let's talk about those two that you mentioned specifically, Ian Fleming and John le Carré. Fleming, who was involved in espionage during World War II, and le Carré then involved subsequently during the Cold War, worked for both MI5 and MI6. In the case of Fleming and his creation, James Bond, is that just a kind of a comic book fantasy version of espionage?
That's probably a fair description. And to an extent, I think Fleming might have agreed with that, or at least he might have agreed with it, you know, one day and disagreed the next day. But he definitely had a fair amount of experience at the administration and planning levels. He had been in journalism. He'd tried his hand at a couple of jobs, failed at being a stockbroker, for example. He worked as a reporter for Reuters and was actually in Moscow in the late 1930s, covering one of Stalin's show trials. At the beginning of the war, connections got him into the Admiralty and he became involved in naval intelligence. And it turned out he had quite a talent for administration, but also planning covert operations and deception strategies. And he, if you like, had a sense of the atmosphere of intelligence. But for Bond, I think there was something else going on he wanted. I mean, you said perhaps kind of comic book or cartoon figure. I think it was Bond was an attempt to inject a sense of glamour into what was really an unglamorous profession.
Now, there are Bond short stories, there are Bond novels. You've read the shorts, obviously you've read the novels and the short stories, but is there a difference between them, or is James Bond pretty much the same in the novels and in the short stories?
The short stories are interesting. Certainly, they often look at Bond, they often present Bond from a different angle than what you see in the novels. The first few novels that Fleming published, the first five or six, beginning with Casino Royale, which I happen to think is quite a decent piece of work, they were mostly well received. He got moderate to positive reviews. And the second phase, the novels he wrote in the 60s, which had less of a Cold War theme, that had a touch of not exactly fantasy, but they were far removed from the somewhat more authentic settings of the first few novels, they began to generally receive negative reviews. It was ironic, perhaps, because that was the moment when the film people stepped in and the Bond movie franchise was born. But I think that the short stories sometimes have surprises. There is a short story called A Quantum of Solace, which was much, much later the title of one of the films, nothing to do with the story itself. But that one genuinely surprised me. It's set in the Caribbean. It was published about 1959, just about the time the Castro rebellion was about to take power in Cuba. And obviously, Castro then turned very much toward the Soviet Union. So it was somewhat of a surprise to see in the story a moment when Bond says that, if anything, his sympathies are with the Castro rebels. That, let's say, was not exactly an expected position that you would think that Fleming would have his character take. So there are certainly in the short stories some unexpected elements that show Fleming, show Bond in a different light.
Now, when it comes then to le Carré, he's quite the opposite, isn't he? I mean, George Smiley, you've got to see George Smiley as anti-Bond. He's very, very different.
Very much so. I think that it's often perhaps been a little bit exaggerated, but I am not sure really if le Carré himself consciously intended to put something out there which was diametrically opposed to the style and atmosphere and implication of Fleming's novels. But he began quite early on to be regarded in that light. And certainly there were elements in le Carré, the portrayal of the bureaucratic nature of intelligence institutions, the portrayal of a kind of cynical expediency that showed intelligence organizations willing to accept collateral damage. I mean, innocent people getting caught up in something that they have no way of controlling. And having, in the case of Smiley, a middle-aged intelligence officer, you know, a very unglamorous figure who is deeply in love with a wife who likes him but follows her own feelings, takes other lovers, and in a sense, these novels present Smiley as the opposite of a darkly romantic Bond-type figure.
The chapter in your book on Le Carré is called John Le Carré and the Jews. So, I mean, that's an example of a layer to his novels that you discovered rereading them as an adult, isn't it?
Yes, very much so. It wasn't something that I particularly noticed when I read Le Carré when I was younger. But going back and reading the early novels again, and also reading some academic studies of Le Carré, I mean, Le Carré is one espionage author for whom there is a certain amount of scholarly and critical writing already. If you read from his very first novel, Call for the Dead, published in 1961, right through to The Tailor of Panama, which I think is 1996, you can see a sort of through line. You can see these characters who are Jewish, sometimes half-Jewish, who play different roles, usually but not always a secondary figure, but often an important figure. And their Jewish identity is problematic in some way. It makes them partly insiders, especially to English culture or British culture. They seem to hover a little on the edge of acceptance. There's a certain historical trauma that they sometimes carry, as Elsa Fennin in his very first novel, who is a German or Austrian refugee who survived the Nazis, right down to the protagonist of The Tailor of Panama, who is actually pretending to be Jewish, but in fact is not. And that novel itself is a kind of homage to Graham Greene's Our Man in Havana. But the role of the Jewish character as a kind of half-outsider, half-insider, somebody who carries a certain weight of historical vulnerability with him or with her, I think that's quite striking when you read Le Carré's novels all the way through from the 60s to the 90s.
Now, in one chapter, you look at the work of Gerald Seymour, the English writer who previously a journalist who wrote three novels about espionage in Northern Ireland. The first of those is 1975. That's Harry's Game, which was, of course, famously turned into a TV series. And then you have Field of Blood. That's 10 years later. And then finally, The Journeyman Taylor in 1992. So there's 15 years between book one and book three. Do those novels reflect the different phases of the conflict between 75 and 92?
I think they very much do so. If you take them as a trilogy, I mean, I call them a trilogy in my book, although the stories themselves are not kind of connected in that way. But the setting, the thematic elements definitely show a progression. I think Harry's Game, which was actually Seymour's first novel, it came out in 1975, that was when the conflict in Northern Ireland was obviously in its early years. It was a little unpredictable. In the early 70s, it wasn't necessarily clear that this would go on for 30 years. There was an element of unpredictability. Something might happen. You know, there might be some move by the British government. There might be some move on the side of Sinn Féin and the IRA that could change things. When you get to Seymour's second novel, Field of Blood, the primary theme is the Supergrass project, where, you know, British intelligence and the RUC and the Crown Forces attempted not only to penetrate Republican circles and the IRA command structure, but also try to get people to turn, essentially to give evidence in court against their comrades. This was at a time when the conflict had become mechanical in a way. It was almost as if the roles of, say, the British forces, the role of the IRA, had become set in a groove, as it were. Nobody could get the edge. And I think the British, clearly by the early 80s, had decided that military force was not going to offer the successful solution. And the Supergrass project was a way of trying to get that edge. When you look at his last novel of that trilogy, The Journeyman Tailor in 92, which I think is the best of the three, I think it's a very powerful piece of work. By then, there's a feeling of war weariness. It's been over 20 years. And again, it's something of an impasse. The British, the RUC, they can't move beyond a certain point. And on the side of the armed struggle and militant Republican movement, it was obvious that they, in a sense, had also reached a point beyond which they did not seem to be able to move. And there were several attempts to kind of make, to try and do something dramatic which would change the situation. And I think the IRA, the Canary Wharf bombing, I think is a good example of that. But you take the three novels together, Harry's Game, Field of Blood, and The Journeyman Tailor, and I think you get a very good feel for the way the conflict in Northern Ireland developed over those 25 years.
Well, the book is called Reading Espionage Fiction, Narrative Conflict and Commitment from World War I to the Contemporary Era. It's published by Edinburgh University Press. The author is my guest, Martin Griffin, and the book is out in paperback this summer. Martin, many thanks indeed for joining us on The History Show.
Thank you, Miles. I enjoyed it.